If I put you in front of a map of the United States and asked you to point to where you thought American economic recovery and growth were taking place, well, you could be forgiven if you focused on the usual suspects, regions on the Pacific and Atlantic coasts and the shores of the Great Lakes. But the best economic growth activity is actually taking place elsewhere, and that's what we're going to find out about today. We'll find out where these areas are and why they're the best bet for America's economic future. My guest is Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University, contributing editor of the City Journal. He's also an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and his new report, entitled America's Growth Corridors, the Key to National Revival, can be found on the At Issue webpage. Go to WPR.org, click on At Issue, and you'll find a link to the report there. Joel Kotkin, welcome to At Issue.
Nice to be here.
So why does most of the discussion about American economic recovery and growth tend to focus on what you refer to as the usual suspects?
Well, because that's where most of the reporters live, and that's the world they live in. Obviously, they focus on Wall Street. Some people focus on Silicon Valley. One of the unfortunate things that's happened in the last, particularly now over the last 5 or 6 years, is as the media has consolidated and become, particularly the mainstream media, has become smaller, and there's sort of less reporting from out in the country, it's become even more focused on these, sort of narrow geographies, really largely New York City and Washington, D.C., and the fact is that this is a very big country. Anyone who's driven across it knows how big it is. What's interesting is how it's changed and how this may be a good thing for the whole country.
Okay, but I think people can be forgiven for making some of those choices because the East and West Coast, that's where a lot of the population lives. We're talking about some of America's biggest cities. Shouldn't we be looking to them to lead our growth?
Well, we should be looking at what the statistics tell us. We know where has been the strongest GDP growth, where has been the strongest job growth, where are our fastest growing cities. And you'll generally find them in these what I call growth corridors. Not exclusively. There are pockets that are doing very well in other areas. But overwhelmingly, these areas that I've identified are growing much more rapidly and are enjoying higher income growth, higher wage growth. GDP and even, surprisingly, population growth.
Okay, so that pretty much then would define what the characteristics of a growth corridor would be for you then, correct?
Right. And part of it is just the way history acts. People move from one place to another. This has really been the history of the United States in particular. People have moved from an area that's already settled that maybe has become expensive, or all the good real estate is taken, and they start looking for something else. So, somebody leaves New England and goes to Wisconsin, and somebody maybe at one point leaves Wisconsin and goes to Washington State. People are always moving. What's different now is the basic narrative of American history has really been east to west. And now we're seeing a movement back towards the center of the. That's a real change.
Well, let's talk about where these growth corridors are. You identify four of them. Tell us about them.
Okay, the three that are very strong, and one that I think is a little bit more of a reach, but I'm willing to take it. The three that are doing exceptionally well, the Great Plains, which is one of the great stories of the early 21st century America. Here's an area that they're going to turn it into the Buffalo Commons. It was a mistake. We should have gotten out of there. Towns were dying. Even the cities were dying. This was a place with essentially no role in the American future except as a giant wildlife refuge. Now it has higher than average growth across the spectrum. It's growing population-wise, mostly in its cities, much more quickly than the rest of the country. It has almost all the real low unemployment states are in the Great Plains. And it's an area that you really would start in sort of West Texas or even Central Texas, and you move all the way up to the Canadian border. The second one, which has done consistently well, is what I would call the Intermountain West, which really starts at the edge of the plains, at the western edge of the plains, and goes all the way to the mountains of the, you know, really to the Cascades and the Sierra to a large extent. But this is really an area, if you will, whose principal cities are Denver and Salt Lake City. And those cities have done very, very well. They have natural resources like the Great Plains. I mean, obviously, natural resources, particularly oil and natural gas, are key to this. They've become great magnets of migration from both coasts, particularly from the West Coast. The third area is what I call the Third Coast, which is really American history started right on the East Coast with the connection to Europe. In my own lifetime, and I've written several books and chronicled this myself, and it's been pretty evident, the shift to the Pacific with the growth of China, Japan, and then China. That was the sort of the second coast, and the U.S. trade and economic relations began to really be dominated by the what you might call the second coast. The third coast is the Gulf Coast. It's always been kind of the Mosquito Coast. It's been left behind. You know, New Orleans' greatest days were in the 1840s and 1850s. And now this is the area which has had some of the most rapid industrial growth in the United States. Obviously, again, huge energy finds and very rapid economic growth. And I would argue the presence of what is probably the most interesting, fast-growing, and dynamic major metropolitan area in the United States, which is Houston. And then there's the fourth one, and this is the one where it took the most most of a leap of faith to name this one, which is the Southeast Industrial Belt. If you think about the basically, if you get off the Gulf Coast and you go everywhere, let's say to Nashville, Charlotte, Raleigh, Atlanta, and these areas, of course, have been growing for many years. But what's been happening has been their rapid industrialization. These areas are now becoming really a competitor with the Great Lakes and growing much more rapidly as an industrial center. And as the United States begins to become, and I think this is very good, a major producer of its own energy and with a shift of manufacturing back to the United States, they're in a pretty good position. So those are the four areas that I see the greatest potential in. I think there are other areas in the country, and notably, actually, I've written a report about the Great Lakes, that have potential to sort of become growth corridors themselves. But these four, the data was pretty compelling.
Well, why the sudden boom in these regions? I mean, in your Wall Street Journal piece, you say that historically these regions were little more than resource colonies or low-wage labor sites for richer, more technically advanced areas. But now things have changed.
Well, I think there are several things. One is obviously the energy revolution, which is probably going to have more to do with reshaping the American landscape in the next 20 or 30 years, most particularly the natural gas revolution, because what the natural gas revolution has done is it has allowed us to get to a massive reduction in our greenhouse gases without having to destroy the economy. So that I think, you know, that's been one big factor. Food, commodities, a huge factor today. As the global middle class begins to grow, not only do they want energy, but they want food. They want better quality food. So let's say soybeans that are grown in the Great Plains or in the Midwest go to China to feed pigs because now Chinese are eating meat every day instead of once a week. Given the numbers in China, that's pretty significant. And then you also have increasingly technological changes, which allow for technology to transfer much more rapidly from one part of the country to the other. And then the last factor, I think, is really the change in the business climate. A lot of these states have a better business climate. They have lower taxes. And companies, in part because of technology, are able to move much more rapidly. So you have sophisticated companies like Mercedes and Volkswagen making huge investments in the Southeast, where in the past there was not the technological ability to really absorb these kind of industries. So I think you're seeing this change taking place for, you know, some very basic reasons. And frankly, part of it is a place that wants to grow. I mean, one of the things that makes, let's say, California limited in its potential from where it was 30 or 40 years ago is many Californians and many political forces here, and I live in Los Angeles myself, really don't want growth. They figure that we have enough people, and you've got a legacy of people who already have theirs. They already have money. Whereas, you know, what I was trying to express was that when you look at the psychology of the growth corridors, many of these are areas that have felt that they were being left behind. They maybe have a little bit of an inferiority complex, and they want to catch up. Just as another thing that I witnessed myself personally was the rise of East Asia, where they felt that they had been left behind, and now they were going to catch up, and of course they did.
We're talking about economic growth in America and how it may not be taking place where you might expect, but where it is taking place, some huge potential for growth. We're talking about America's growth corridors and wondering, well, what do you think about all of this? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. talk@WPR.org is the email address, and you can also find us on Facebook. I'm talking with Joel Kotkin, whose report, America's Growth Corridors, the Key to National Revival, is linked to the At Issue page at WPR.org. You can take a look at it and see what he has to say about where the growth is taking place. When we come back, Joel Kotkin, I want to talk about jobs. I mean, what do we know about jobs in these regions that you've identified as these growth corridors? What can people expect there? 800-642-1234. We're going to pause for just a moment, and we'll be right back with more economic growth talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Coming up on Monday, Joy Cardine will be in, and as always on Monday morning at 7, it's the State Capitol Report. Governor Walker is expected to sign the mining bill into law, but litigation may prevent an iron ore mine from actually being built. In this week's State Capitol Report, Joy Cardine will be talking with WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson about mining's uncertain future in Wisconsin. That's coming up Monday morning here on the Ideas Network. This is At Issue. I'm John Munson. My guest is Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University and also an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has a new report titled America's Growth Corridors, the Key to National Revival, and we're talking about what's in that report with him and with you at 800-642-1234. So, Joel Kotkin, jobs. What about them? What's the job situation in these corridors you're talking about?
Well, in some of these places, there's very low unemployment. You look at the lowest unemployment in the U.S., it's Nebraska, the Dakotas are really the states with low unemployment. Wyoming, Utah has low unemployment. Most of these states have very low unemployment, and of course they have pretty considerable job growth. This is taking place also in places, for instance, like along the Gulf Coast. Again, Houston, New Orleans has made a pretty strong recovery, so these are really areas where there's a tremendous amount of opportunity. I just came back from Houston yesterday, and if there is a recession, you could have fooled me, because there was new building all over the place. New shopping, new apartments, new houses. You go to the restaurants and the bars are just packed with people, and not just in like in New York, where there are certain areas of Manhattan that are doing very, very well, but other parts not so well. It would seem pretty widespread. There's just a sense of sort of recreation of sort of an American economic expansion. And I think it will benefit the rest of the country as well. I don't think it's a zero-sum game.
And what are the demographics that you saw there? Who's living there?
Well, what you have in a place like Houston is, you've had a tremendous growth in the foreign-born. I mean, over the last decade, Houston has almost had about a four times more people, actual numbers of foreign-born people move into Houston than, let's say, here in Los Angeles, which is always or has been in the last few decades really a big immigrant location. You have a very strong in-migration from other parts of the country. So you have a lot of young people from in their 20s and 30s relocating to Houston because there are jobs. I mean, they're not going for the climate, and they're not going for the topography. They're going for the jobs, for the economic opportunity. And you have very strong job growth in what we would call STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics-related skills, much of it with energy. But you also have the world's largest medical center is in Houston. So there's lots of things going on, and it's attracting people for the same reasons that, for instance, reminds me very much of Los Angeles when I moved here in the mid-70s. It was a place that people from other countries and from other parts of the U.S. came for economic opportunity. It was a youngish population. It was a very diverse population. It was a very ambitious population.
But young people also want a thriving city and an exciting environment around them. How do you make somewhere like the Great Plains sexy?
Well, Houston obviously is different than, let's say, Omaha. But what these places have done, Omaha, Oklahoma City, even I was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, not too long ago, what you find is that these cities have built up their amenity structures. They'll have a performing arts center. They'll have some decent restaurants. They'll have a nice restored hotel. You go to Fargo. When I first went to Fargo, North Dakota, must be almost 20 years ago, it was bleak. I mean, I used to bring my own coffee, okay? I mean, you couldn't get a good cup of coffee. Now there's lots of coffee places. There are Indian restaurants. There are, sort of local, locavore restaurants. There are decent Italian restaurants. So a lot of these things come up. Now, are they going to be hip, cool, great places for 25-year-old performance artists? Nah, probably not. But for a lot of younger people, particularly as millennials begin to go into their 30s and start thinking about buying a house, starting a family, a lot of these places are going to become more attractive to them. And that's part of the reason I think that they will continue to grow. It's really quite interesting how these cities that were very, very, sort of dowdy and not very interesting are now, much more attractive. I was walking with a friend on the main street of Fargo, and we couldn't get into the bars. They were so crowded, and they were filled with these young, attractive people. And you're saying, this is Fargo? I'll tell you one thing, they weren't there 20 years ago.
Let's hear what Tim in Eau Claire has to say. Tim, good afternoon. Hello, Tim. I'm not hearing Tim. Well, let's see if we can get reconnected to Tim. I guess Tim's not there. Okay, well. So from what you're saying, it sounds like it's up to us to adjust our preconceptions about these areas of the country, which some people still refer to as the flyover zone, for example.
Well, and I think that's something that's going to change. I wrote the book, The Next 100 Million, about America in 2050, and this is something that I started to think about while I was writing the book. This country's great strength compared to many of its competitors is that it's a huge country and it has many different places for people to go. And what keeps America going is the fact that people are able and companies are able to go and find new places to do things. You think about the whole recreation of America in many ways in the period from 1975, let's say, to even, let's say, 2000 and even a little beyond that. When there was a vast movement of people, first from the Midwest and then from the East Coast, to California. I mean, California essentially created much of early 21st century America, was recreated here on the West Coast. We're seeing that process starting again, but it's increasingly in the middle parts of the country. The whole Great Plains, the Intermountain West, the Southeast, and the Gulf Coast. And these were places that had been, to some extent, left behind in most of the 20th century.
You mentioned commodities earlier when you were talking about, you know, all the food that's produced. Of course, the Great Plains is and parts of the Intermountain West are great food producing areas. On the other hand, there is an historic drought which has plagued much of the Great Plains and the upper Midwest for the last couple of years. How would that affect your thinking about those areas in terms of economic growth? Because if the commodities markets collapse, or if there's a great problem in the commodities markets, that would tend to affect that.
Well, I mean, of course, the Great Plains have had many droughts in the past, and the question is how persistent is this and how well is it managed? They've had quite a bit of snow, so hopefully it will be better in the year coming up. There's been some pretty big snows also in the Intermountain West. You know, one thing about flying around the country is you get to see the snow cover. And being now after 40 years in California, I think snow is good to look at. I'm not so happy about living in it. But fundamentally, I think that, if it went for a long period of time, it would be hard. But on the other hand, there's sometimes you have the droughts bad in one part of the Great Plains, particularly in the southern Great Plains, not so bad in the northern Great Plains. Higher commodity prices actually help those, those people.
We're going to take a break, check some news, and come back. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. What do you think about all this? 800-642-1234. We'll take calls on the other side of the news. I'm John Munson. This is At Issue on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. America has emerging growth corridors, regions in our country that are economically thriving. We're talking about where those are, why they're thriving, and what the rest of the nation can learn from them with Joel Kotkin, who is the author of a report titled America's Growth Corridors, The Key to National Revival, and a link to that can be found on the At Issue page at WPR.org. I'm John Munson. This is At Issue. And let's start out by taking some phone calls. We'll start in Madison. Dennis is with us. Dennis, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Do green energy jobs have anything at all to do with any of the growth in the these corridors? That's the question.
Sure. Well, as you may know, Texas is now the leader in wind energy. The Great Plains in particular is very well suited for the for that kind of for wind energy, and obviously parts of the southern plains also are pretty good for solar. But frankly, relative to natural gas and oil, pretty insignificant. Most of the growth, and particularly in the high wage, largely not subsidized in any major way, it's pretty much oil and gas. And of course, I'm more excited about the gas part of it, but I definitely think that that's where the job growth has been. It hasn't been. I mean, given California's policy, if green jobs were the thing that was really happening, we wouldn't have the nation's third highest unemployment rate.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Dave in Appleton. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. You touched a little bit on climate before. You asked for our droughts in the plain states, but there aren't a lot of people there, but it can severely affect agriculture. What I'm wondering is, in some of the growth areas, like Texas is probably going to be in a perpetual drought. The intermountain states are losing their snow caps, so they're not going to have the water resources to support the cities. And it's going to be blistering hot all along the coast states. I mean, Arizona isn't part of this, but we all know that now Arizona, the 100-degree days and 120-degree days are going up astronomically. I mean, overall, so we have an energy industry, but then, are people going to find this to be dry and just so blasted hot that they're going to come up to the nice, cool Wisconsin with clean, fresh water?
Well, there's always wishful thinking. I do think that water is the great advantage over time of the Great Lakes, has always been, by the way. I'm not about to predict what the climate's going to be like. you know, the worst drought I ever experienced when I was a reporter was not anything recent. It was actually quite a long time ago. It was about there was a very, very severe drought here in California in the 1970s. Obviously, the droughts of the 30s were worse. I'm not prescient enough to know exactly what's going to happen. There have been so many predictions by all sorts of people that have been, over the top, and there's a sort of a logic that people develop. You know, my study of history is that, there are a lot of curveballs out there, and you never quite know what's going to happen. I do think that the issue of water in the southern Great Plains, I think, is going to be a major issue. Some of the issues in the other parts have a lot to do with how we use water. For instance, here in the state of California, we may want to rethink whether we should be using water to grow cotton in the Central Valley, and maybe we ought to use that water for things that, frankly, only we can really grow successfully, almonds and, certain kinds of fruit trees that our climate and soil are better for. So there certainly are changes that can be made. The vast majority, of course, of the water that's used in these western states, these irrigation states, tend to be in agriculture. So you could see some pressure on agriculture if you had prolonged droughts. But remember, the Southeast had a huge drought about 4 or 5 years ago that is now, pretty much petered out. So, we'll just have to see. Now, if we are in a long-term problem with water, it could certainly affect some of this. But on the other hand, people were predicting that we were headed towards peak oil and peak gas, and that didn't happen either. So, I just tend to say, this may be a factor. Certainly, I would advise people in those parts of the country to keep an eye on these things. But I would also not get too hysterical about, we're going to run out of water completely. Because, frankly, the history of, having been, written histories of this part of the country, we've had terrible droughts. There were many periods where actually Los Angeles was almost abandoned in the 1860s because of a drought. So, what between technology and, how the climate may change, it's just very hard to predict. But it is a serious issue. And in the work I've done on the Great Plains, I did a report for Texas Tech, the southern Great Plains, I think, do have somewhat of a serious water issue down
well,
the road.
The Ogallala Water Aquifer is, some have said, is in danger of being depleted.
Right,
and that's where a lot of the water comes from for that section of the country.
Right. There is also, from what I understand, another aquifer underneath it, which is larger, and I just don't know whether or not they can tap it or not. But certainly the people I've worked with at Texas Tech are concerned about that issue, and I think it is something that's legitimate. And again, I would argue that for the Great Lakes, your water resources are one of your tremendous advantages. And if we are having a significant warming in the short term, then this could be to the advantage, as the gentleman suggested, of places like in the Great Lakes, and where there is where there's more water and the climate I assume you find it cold enough already, so probably.
Well, I'll tell you what, it does get pretty hot up here in the summertime and very humid, so not always that cool paradise unless you're actually in the water. Of course, if you're in Lake Superior, it's pretty much always cold. Let's go to Charlie in Monona. Charlie, go ahead.
Good afternoon, guys. I had a question as to whether your growth corridors or any of the results of your study point to good places to retire.
That's a very good point. This is what I ran into recently, and I don't have the details, but you might want to look into it. Of course, there's always been people going to Florida, and I think they still do. But the place I've been hearing a lot about is South Carolina. Apparently, they have tax incentives for retirees, and the parts of the Charlotte area, Charlotte's on the border of North and South Carolina, have apparently a lot of the old sort of county courthouse areas, which have nice main streets, have actually been attracting a lot of retirees. And South Carolina has a mild climate. It's not as hot. And, of course, I think one of the great places to retire, if you can afford it, are the islands off Charleston. I don't think it gets much better than that. So, and again, you have, you know, lower taxes, lower costs. I mean, one of the things I think we will be seeing, particularly from the Northeast and California, are people going to these lower tax states and lower cost states. You know, you sell your house in Connecticut for $800,000, you buy a really nice house in South Carolina for $250,000, and there's your nest egg.
Charlie, thanks. Thanks for that call. One of the things that some people have said about the growth that's taking place in some of these areas is that it's been some of it's been driven by low wages. Could you address that?
Sure, and that's my good friend Harold Meyerson, and I have had this discussion several times. Who's at the American Prospect? You know, I would put it this way: I think that was historically the case. That was why the textile industry, for instance, left New England, went to the South. And it is true that you probably have somewhat lower wages, although if you're looking at the new things that are coming in, let's say petrochemicals, steel, they don't pay particularly low wages, particularly when you give the cost of living. And, of course, as you may know from being in Wisconsin and having a big presence of the big three, that the new people hired don't get anything like the deals that the older people got. So actually the deals that people are getting, let's say if you're in Tupelo, Mississippi, and you're going to start building Priuses for Toyota, are not much worse, and in many ways, given the cost of living, better than what you might get in a UAW plant. And you have to remember, when if you're in a place like Tupelo, Mississippi, or you know, rural Tennessee, and you know, somebody's paying you, you know, $17 an hour, starting with medical benefits. You know, that's pretty good. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people wait for those jobs. You know, on the other hand, you know, if you get a candy store opens up with some retail jobs in New York City, there are lines around the block. So, you know, I would say yes, they're coming for lower wages in some cases, but increasingly the jobs, for instance, in manufacturing, really require some training and skill. It doesn't even make sense for the employer to pay very low wages. I was recently in areas outside of New Orleans in some of the outer parishes, and you know, a new job at a petrochemical plant. You know, you may have you graduate from high school, you have a 1 year training period to get a certificate, and you're making $75,000 a year. Well, you know, in rural Louisiana, $75,000 a year for a 19-year-old isn't so bad.
Joel Kotkin, we've talked about what these regions are doing well. What areas do they need to improve on, do you think?
Well, it depends on the region. They're not all the same. The Great Plains and the Intermountain West are, for instance, are both pretty good in education. Their percentage of BAs, high school graduation rates are quite high. I've even used the term, instead of the grain belt, the brain belt. North Dakota kids are just amazing. I've spent a lot of time in North Dakota. And, you know, the basic literacy level is actually quite high. You know, very much like all the sort of, you know, areas that of German and Scandinavian settlement in the United States have, you know, kind of similar characteristics. The Intermountain West attracts a lot of well-educated people, particularly both the Denver and the Salt Lake City area, particularly from the West Coast, and of course the education system in Utah. The Mormons have a fairly high level of education themselves. They have a great stress on that. Different story in the Southeast, and I think this is, and I make this point in the paper. The Southeast and the Third Coast generally lag behind the national average. They are investing massively in their education systems. The University of Texas has really come on as a major university. Obviously, you're probably familiar with the University of North Carolina. Also, Vanderbilt in Nashville. So these areas are increasing the numbers of BAs, actually some of the most rapid growth in that area of any part of the country. But they're very aware that they need to raise the level of literacy and level of education. And many states, like, for instance, both South Carolina and Tennessee, have a lot of work on vocational education, because many of the jobs that are really necessary in this country and have good opportunity are not four-year college degrees. They're certificate one-year, two-year degrees. And so they, I think they are aware of that. And it is certainly one of the things that they have a problem with. I think in the Gulf Coast area, only Houston is slightly above the national average.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Joel Kotkin, I want to talk about what other areas of the country might learn from these corridors that you identify in your report, and maybe we can go on from there. Also wondering what our listeners think about what we've talked about so far. If you've got an opinion or a question, please give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Look for At Issue Show. I'm John Munson. It's At Issue on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on At Issue after 4 o'clock, it's your views on the news. Lots of news to talk about, and we're hoping you'll join in and let us know what story really made you sit up and take notice during the week, and we hope you'll tell us why. 800-642-1234, the number to call with your question now for our guest about these growth corridors, and wondering what you think about what we've discussed so far. Well, Joel Kotkin, what can other areas of the state, or excuse me, other areas of the United States, learn from what's happening in these areas where we're seeing this growth? What are the takeaways and things that they could actually do to make things better in their part of the
well,
world?
Some of the things we already are seeing, and again, particularly in the Great Lakes, I think states are much more focused on their competitiveness. They realize, for instance, that if you're going to maintain your industrial base in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, you're going to have a better business climate. I think that that's something that you could take away. You have to understand that you are now competing with many more states than you had to. I see this, for instance, in the technology industry, as I've been trying to discuss this with people here in California. You know what? A tech company may start here in Silicon Valley or in San Diego, but when they expand, can they expand here? Is housing too expensive? Are we not providing the training for the not the very top people, but the people underneath them? So to understand that you're in a competitive economy, not just globally, but within the United States. And so 30 years ago, no one here in California would have considered the University of Texas or Austin or Raleigh as a serious competitor for the technology industries that we have here. Obviously, that has changed. And so there has to be a greater awareness of the competitive challenge. Now, you may not want to adopt all the same strategies, and you may not be able to, but you've certainly got to come up with some sort of strategy to stay competitive. It may have to be based on your own historic strengths, but you certainly cannot just sit there and say, well, we've had this industry forever. It's going to stay here forever. I think, you know, we know that's not true.
You have a graphic in your report from Chief Executive Magazine listing the best states for business in 2012, and I noticed that Wisconsin is a top 20 state, not in the top 10, but certainly in the top 20. What's Wisconsin doing well right now, do you think?
Well, you know, whether you agree with him on a lot of other things, Walker, like Snyder in Michigan, and some of the others, obviously Mitch Daniels when he was in Indiana, has changed the perception, at least, of these states as being business-friendly. And I think that changes things. Again, I believe, and I've actually done some work in Wisconsin, and I've spoken there numerous times, I think Wisconsin has some great assets. And the question is, if you are relatively friendly to business, if you're able to strike a good deal for people, Wisconsin has enormous amounts to offer. It has a great education system. It has a fairly strong work ethic. It's a very attractive state. It's not too expensive. And so I think that the Great Lakes, and I did do a report, it's on my website, about the Great Lakes. I think the Great Lakes has tremendous potential to come roaring back. And interestingly enough, that part of the country now has lower unemployment than the national average. So something is happening in many of these states. And again, I think it's one of those funny things where competition works. The fact that there is so much competition in states, it probably drives the economic development people and the people in the governor's office crazy, but it may have a very good long-term effect, because you've got to say, hey, you know, this company wants to, let's say, expand in whether it's in tech or manufacturing or in energy, and to know that they can go somewhere else. So you've got to figure out how you essentially sell yourselves and create a better product so that individuals or companies go to your state.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Campbellsport and hear from Arnold. Arnold, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. It's a very interesting subject. But from what I'm seeing in the last 60, 70 years, is a complete turnaround. Years ago, we had conservation practices passed just on our farmland, and it was issued by the government. A lot of things like tiling and all sorts of rotating crops and water construction, where you divert the water from the wetlands and all kinds, these are dropped today. They're not there. Now we got the great big farms. We're using at least 3 billion gallons of water a year in our agriculture. We're using water to wash down the barns. We've never done that before. We're using everything detrimental to everything. It runs in the water. You can't control it. Well, if you get a heavy rain, it's in the water and gone into our lakes.
Okay, Arnold, I think we get it. Arnold's got some concerns about modern agricultural practices damaging our environment. Are we changing the way we're approaching agriculture?
Well, I think there's some of that is going on, and I think we see it. To some extent here in California, you know, where people are using drip irrigation a little bit more. There's obviously a lot of work on crops that consume less water and need less pesticides. But this is a continuing struggle, and I think, but it is something that is happening. And then on the farm side, I've been doing a little work on agriculture. What's interesting is, you do have these big farms, but there's really been quite a growth in small farms. I think there's a greater interest in local produce and having things fresh from the market. And so you see some thriving parts of agriculture in smaller farms near large cities. So, you know, you have a thriving agriculture in some of the areas, for instance, around San Francisco or in Ventura County outside of L.A. and Santa Barbara, which are servicing the parts of the market in some of these big cities. So I don't see it as all negative. I think there are changes taking place as the market shifts that are quite positive.
Well, you're in Los Angeles now. Based on what you know, will you be staying or do you have another city in mind?
Well, the way I look at it is, you know, I just turned 60, and when you've got kids and aging, parents, and you've been someplace for 40 years, older people generally don't move that much.
I feel you.
Okay, but if I was 35 and ambitious, I'd head on over to Houston.
Okay. I remember being 35 and ambitious. Joel Kotkin, thank you for this conversation. It was fascinating.
Well, thank you very much.
Joel Kotkin, author of a new report titled America's Growth Corridors, The Key to National Revival. You can find a link to it on the Ad Issue page on WPR.org. Chris Molina produced this program, on-air production by Michelle Good. I'm John Munson. The program is Ad Issue. You're listening to it on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.